Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect today would like you to think about the rise in food prices and the rise projected for Ontarians on fixed incomes, especially Ontario Works and Ontario Disability Support, of 1%. Disrespect has word that Dalton McGuinty plans, if reelected, to raise fixed incomes in Ontario by 6%. When you listen to Francis Fong, you'll hear that food is going to go up by 6%. So basically what you're getting is the ability not to starve from Dalton McGuinty if you vote for him. So stay with us today while we reveal the future on Disrespect. Disrespect introduces Francis Fong, an economist with the TD Bank Group. He's going to talk to us about trends in food inflation and the meaning of past, present, and future inflation as we see it today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Okay. We were just talking about the variety of opinions on food inflation. I don't know if the variety affects vested interests or legitimately individual interpretations of the data, but as I said to you, it looks to me like the beginning of a parabolic curve.
Right.
You know, first we hear that Canada's lucky, there's no inflation, and then we hear, well, Canada's still lucky, there's very little inflation, and then we hear we're setting new records for inflation, but it's nothing terrifying yet. Mm-hmm. And your opinion seemed to be that, yeah, it might be the beginning of a parabolic curve, but it's a slow one.
Right, so I think the key thing here is that, I mean, our view is that it is sort of, we're going to see a cyclical impact on food prices. Now, so far, we haven't really seen that in Canadian inflation. When we got February's numbers a little bit ago, we had a slight uptick in it. It was 3-point-something percent.
Right.
3.3 percentage points year over year. But the prior 2 months were something like 2.1%. So, you know, up to this point, we're starting to see it, but we haven't seen it up to this point. But if we look internationally, so beyond Canadian borders, if we look at places like China, Indonesia, India, Brazil, a lot of these emerging markets, they tend to feel it a lot quicker than we do. You know, we have sort of like these offsetting, mitigating factors like the high Canadian dollar and things like that. But their food inflation has been running pretty hot for the better part of a year.
Yeah.
And the UN tracks these food price increases. They have a food price index that the world tends to look at. And food prices have been rising since last June. So they've been rising for quite some time now. And only now are we starting to see it pick up in Canada.
Yeah. Well, they've seen it in the Middle East before we have.
Oh, absolutely. And again, that was sort of fueled speculation that the cause of these this geopolitical unrest mm-hmm. is actually because, you know, people can't really afford to eat all that much.
And that would do it.
It's a huge issue. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm speculating that something like this is in the offing in Canada mm-hmm. among fixed income and low income people if food prices don't level off or if incomes don't rise. And
absolutely.
I suppose if food prices are part of a larger inflation, then yeah, theoretically, these incomes should rise. Some of them are inflation indexed, but unfortunately, a lot of the provincial ones are not.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, if we look at the cause of the actual inflation first, and we try and think about how bad it can get. I mean, let's just focus on food. Forget about rising gas prices and energy prices. Let's just focus on food for now.
Yeah.
What we're expecting is that because of all the bad weather, all the really, really poor weather that we had about 2 years ago or over the past 2 years, that actually destroyed a lot of the global supply of some really critical food commodities, wheat, soybeans, corn, all this kind of stuff, all these really critical commodities.
Even biofuel crops.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. So corn and wheat are both used as biofuel crops. And, you know, we're already, at least not in Canada, but in the U.S. and in Europe, we're mandated to have, or they're mandated to have a certain percentage of their fuel have some sort of biofuel, ethanol or wheat-based ethanol, corn-based ethanol, what have you. So the global supply of these really critical commodities had sort of declined pretty substantially, and that's actually what's driven up prices internationally.
Okay.
So it takes about a year for global food price increases to pass on to Canadian food price increases. So I mentioned before, inflation rose to slightly above 3%, so nothing too serious yet, but it's coming. You know, food inflation in other countries is something like 10 to 15%. What we're anticipating is it's likely going to reach something like 7 to 8%. So from this point onwards, we're looking at about a 6 to 7% increase in food prices sort of across the board from this point on. So it's a big issue specifically for, as you mentioned, people on fixed income.
Now, is this inflation part of the index that the government would use to measure things like pension requirements and so forth, or is it? I think it's considered a volatile commodity, and so it's excluded, isn't it?
I think there's a distinction that needs to be made here, is that there's headline inflation, and then there's something called core inflation. Core inflation, as you had already correctly stated, takes out some of these more volatile components. It does not take out all food. It only takes out fresh fruits and fresh vegetables. That's it.
Okay.
So everything else is still in there. So if food prices are rising dramatically, that's going to feed into core inflation. That being said, it is not that large of a part of the entire sort of basket of expenditures on an annual basis. It's about 17% of a average Canadian household's expenditure is on food. That being said, also, I need to mention that for those who are in the lower income brackets, it's slightly higher. It's actually something like 21%. So going back to this broader inflationary pressure, a lot of these sort of entitlement programs like OAS, GIS, things like that, they get linked to headline inflation. So regardless of what happens, it's going to increase if inflation is sort of above its long-term average.
Okay.
But I guess the issue is, how long do you really think it's going to last? And that's sort of a key aspect. I mean, if inflation rises to 7 to 8% over the next 6 to 7 months, you might see a headline inflation rise by, you know, 2 or 3%, maybe 3%, something like that. I think that's what the Bank of Canada is expecting.
Okay.
It's going to peak at something like 3%. You know, that's still not a very large increase given how much food costs are rising. I mean, and I think the key thing here is, you know, I mentioned that figure, 17% of an average Canadian household's expenditures is on food.
Mm-hmm.
But within that 17%, how much of that is junk food? How much of that is brand name packaged goods? How much of that is things that you can substitute away from? You know, maybe I won't buy the brand name chicken or the brand name bread.
That was
go
in the
generic.
Globe today. That's already happening.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. What the top-tier supermarkets are finding is that their bottom-tier operations, No Frills, Food Basics,
right,
Freshco, are taking their customers from the same company's top-tier stores. And when prices in certain, as you mentioned, fresh commodities, mm-hmm, foods spike, people are turning to alternatives.
Right.
What's on sale? What's cheaper? What hasn't spiked? And I think, I think brand names are going to take a bit of a
bit
of a beating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the key thing here is that, okay, people are already doing that before we've even seen food prices really increase. So we're sort of seeing this people sort of, they're preparing for the inevitable rise in food prices.
Maybe.
But what about those on fixed income, as you mentioned? I also mentioned that figure, that 21% figure for the lowest income bracket, that's what they spend on food. How much of that is already substituted towards things like generic brands? How much of that is already substituted towards on-sale items?
Yeah.
I mean, do they have any more ability to shift their consumption basket to cheaper goods? I don't know the answer to that, and I hope that they would have some ability, but I doubt it.
I don't think they're brand name shoppers.
Exactly right, which is a problem. Which is exactly the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about people on fixed income, if we're talking about people on their pensions and they're on OAS and GIS, it's going to be a tough couple of months for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking particularly about people on provincial incomes.
Right.
The incomes in Ontario, for instance, fixed incomes, have already been declared in the March 2011 budget for 2012. Mm-hmm. And for 2011, they went up 1%.
Right.
And everybody assumed that was a temporary thing to do with the recession.
Right.
And there wasn't a lot of noise. But they've been declared 1% for 2012, too.
Which is going to be a huge issue.
Well, yeah, if you have food going up 7%, 8%, yeah. And as you mentioned, probably staying.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Incomes going up 1% and food is 21% of their budgets. Yeah, there'll be marches.
Absolutely, and I think that, and you brought up a point that I should probably mention to the listeners is when we talk about inflation, that's a year over year increase, not a month to month increase. And
right.
So we're expecting it to hit 7 to 8% on a year over year basis, but then it's going to come back down to something more manageable,
in right.
the 1 to 2% range that it's historically been at.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that prices are actually going to decline.
We're not. Right.
You might
they'll increase less.
They'll just increase at a slower rate that's more consistent with other goods. We might see. Some price give back from the fresh fruits and vegetables from the staples that you know like rice and bread and things like that that's really saw a huge increase. You might see the prices of those goods decline, but on a broad basis, your food bill is not going to go down after this, which is again another issue.
Yeah, and of course in Ontario, and I hear I don't keep track of the dates, but I hear that in 7 or 8 other provinces as well, we're going to have elections this fall.
Right. We're headed for a lot of provincial elections.
Yeah, so we're maybe headed for a lot of pressure from the lower income voters if they do turn out and actually vote to change governments or change policies.
Absolutely, and we've been focusing on food, but we haven't even touched the how much fuel oil is going to increase, how much heating is going to cost, how much electricity is going to cost, how much gas is going to cost. The energy prices are just as much a component as food is, and those prices are increasing just as much. In fact, they're making more headlines than food is right now.
Wow. Yeah.
And you know, I suspect you're right that come election time, it's going to be a huge issue for them.
Yeah. Well, they're just going to have to step out and make themselves heard. I've been thinking too lately about the fact that while tenants and homeowners pay their own hydro rates, and we're now experiencing, for the first time in Ontario, we're experiencing hydro as a value-added tax.
Right.
And they're not liking what they see there. But landlords will be experiencing, in tenant situations, they'll be experiencing fuel price rises.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, the Ontario government has their hold on the landlords because they declare what the landlords can increase rents by.
Exactly right. So I suspect that there's going to be some tension there, you know, between
landlords and government. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just fixed income people, it's the people who support them as well.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, if there are 850,000 people in Ontario on fixed incomes, I wonder how many would be classified as people who depend on them for incomes.
Right.
I don't know.
It's, you know, and we've talked about...
Sounds like we've topped 1 million potential voters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've talked about this issue before of the you know the social safety net, and I mean TD as a group, we've talked about this issue of the social safety net sort of being prohibitive of people getting out of the social safety net.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you get in, it's really difficult to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're under the welfare program, you know you have to give up so much of your assets just to get in.
And, that's true.
You know, and you know when if you go out and you find a new job, you lose so much of the benefits that you had when you're on welfare.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, every extra dollar you make, you actually find that you're actually poorer.
Yeah.
Because you had to give up so much of the benefits that you had to get that extra dollar. So it's really tough for people out there right now.
Yeah. There's already a movement to allow people to keep more assets when they claim welfare.
Exactly.
For instance, your car, if it's worth less than something like $5,200 or something,
mm-hmm.
you can keep it. It's not regarded as a liquid asset because you're probably going to need it to go to work.
Exactly right.
I don't know what the situation is with homes. Theoretically, the fixed income people help you maintain your home if you keep it. There was a time, there maybe still is, when they put a lien on it against the benefits that they give you.
Right.
But I expect that will emerge into the open, that you'll be allowed to keep a home without penalty if you declare yourself in need of fixed income support. I imagine that any reform to the fixed income system will probably formalize these recognitions on a broader basis. I hope it would.
And that
these assets can remain so that people can spring back.
Yeah, actually that's exactly what we're hoping as well. Like, if you're going to reform it, make sure that these people, you know, the program is there to help people in need, but you need to help them get back on their feet. And if you're preventing, and if your program is designed to prevent them to do that, then what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. Because then you've bought into supporting them forever when you might have just had to do it for 4 or 5 years.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And yet our government in Ontario has announced the study of poverty. And in fact, I found out on this show that the people who studied poverty have advocated not releasing the results of their study till after the election. Very odd response, given right. the political weight of those findings. And it may be that a reform of the system is. Now, for a minute, we'll take a break. Steve Dawson, Slow Turns.
I'm gonna pack up my suitcase and live off of what I find. It sounds so sweet to hear your voice, even as I fall behind. I'm gonna catch that silver bullet right between my teeth. Hang on for my dear life as I get out from underneath and take those slow turns. No need to go so fast. Right around the last bend, where the best one finishes last. Well, I'll take all the back roads and find my way with ease. It should have taken me longer, but I'll get there eventually. So look for me at the starting gate at the far end of the street. And when the pistol finally fires, I'll get up to my feet and take those slow turns. No need to go so fast. Right around the last bend, where the best one finishes last.
Already being called for, no one's going to know about it until after they cast their vote.
Right.
And because they don't know, they may cast their vote differently.
I mean, I guess one of the caveats to this discussion that we're having is that, you know, the whole poverty argument is felt from different sort of sectors of society. I mean, there are statistics out there that would suggest that elderly people living in poverty is at its lowest rate ever.
Okay.
And
whose statistics are those? Do you know?
I think I forget exactly what the institute is. It's the it's some kind of a coalition against poverty, and they sort of, and they track it. And because of the improvements to the OAS and the GIS system that have been made over the past, I'm not exactly sure, that's actually brought down the elderly poverty rate to one of its lowest levels ever.
Good.
And same with the child poverty rate. What the interesting thing is, the interesting thing about the statistics is that the people who are most at risk of falling into poverty now are middle-aged people.
Yeah.
People who are sort of just teetering on the brink. And because they don't have the same kind of social security nets that the elderly and the children do, they are the ones that end up falling into poverty. And actually, I think this is sort of one of the first times that the poverty rate amongst those who are middle-aged is actually the highest relative to children and the elderly. So this whole debate is really, it really depends on who you're looking at. You know what I mean?
See.
So there's good and bad to it.
Well, yes, and I've seen the figures that the single people are most at risk of poverty as well. So if
right.
you're middle-aged and single, like you're a single woman who's left a marriage or never married, or for that matter, a single man, and you find yourself dependent on the social safety net, you won't find it there.
Right, absolutely right. Absolutely
yeah.
right.
So what's the impact on, I guess, Ontario's economy? We've already discussed the impact of people remaining on welfare because they're not allowed to retain the assets that would help them climb out. What
right.
are the What's the impact of this continuing pressure on incomes they don't have from, for instance, food?
Right, the impact is nothing good, really.
Yeah.
I can't really paint a good picture about it. If your welfare system is broken, you're not helping these people get back on their feet. You have a huge pool of labor that you could have available potentially to do a variety of jobs in your economy, given that your labor market is able to handle that. But because there's sort of this inhibition, because you get a job and then you have to give up benefits, it's actually sort of a disincentive.
Yeah.
Once you're into that program, so it's nothing good that I can say, because you're basically preventing your labor force from reaching its full potential.
We're already talking about a shortage of skilled labor too, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And these middle-aged people represent the kind of resources that are required to meet that shortage. These people are already trained.
Right, absolutely. I guess one thing we haven't really talked about either is immigration.
All right.
Yeah. So a huge pool of the people who are falling into poverty are actually recent immigrants, people who arrived within the last 5 years or something like that.
I wasn't aware that they were unfairly dealt with, but it's not surprising.
Well, it's interesting. The statistics are quite staggering. I think the probability of you falling into low-income status within your first year as an economic class immigrant is something like 50%.
Oh, no.
One in two will fall into low-income status. Now, that's...
And we qualify these people. These are all well-trained people, aren't
right,
they?
Right, absolutely. And it's unfair to say that they're low-income. Once they arrive in their first year, they might have a tough time finding a job, but they have assets while they're here to sort of live off of. So it's, low-income status is basically, it is somewhat skewed to look at it just like that and say, okay, well, one and two, wow, that's terrible. It's a little skewed to look at that, but it doesn't really paint the best picture ever. And
that's a barrier.
Exactly, it's a barrier, and it's not easy to get out of low income status once you're in there.
Mm-hmm.
So immigrants are also sort of an at risk population that we're worried about as well. So
here we're screening them for their productive potential, and then we're cutting them off at the knees when they arrive. It doesn't seem very enlightened.
Exactly. And we're hoping that immigration reform will also be a big issue as well, because
I haven't heard a word about it in the federal election.
It's come out recently. I think I forget which party's platform sort of made it an issue, but I think it's starting to come to the fore. I think it's an issue that deserves more recognition.
Yeah.
Because we accept 250,000 immigrants a year. We need to
make sure we depend on them for our pension system.
Exactly. Well, not just that, but we also depend on them for our skilled labor force. We have a very slow pace of domestic population growth.
Yes.
We depend on them to support our skilled labor force.
Yeah.
If they come here and they're not able to use their skills well, this is the classic sort of doctors driving cabs and engineers driving cabs issue.
Oh, yeah.
Is that we bring them over and we recognize their skills nationally, but the labor force here does not. That's the issue.
Yeah.
If you have 3 years of work experience being an architect and you come here with the promise that you could use those skills in Canada, and then you get here and nobody recognizes that in the actual labor force, then it's we're not doing a good enough job of making sure that our immigrants are integrating well.
Well, I know what happens too. I mean, you've spent 5 or 6 years acquiring the qualifications. Mm-hmm. As you say, you may have 3 years of experience, but by the time you've been here and you've driven a cab for 3 or 4 years,
right,
you'll find recent architecture graduates looking at you astonished when you say you're looking for a job, and they say, why are you looking for a job? You're a cab driver.
Exactly.
You say, well, no, I have a degree in architecture. No, you know, you're mistaken. You're a cab driver now.
Yep. You spent 5-6 years doing it.
Yeah.
You know, your skills might have degraded since then. It's definitely a lot tougher for a recent immigrant to make it in Canada.
Well, what I'm getting at, I guess, is there's stereotyping, too. If you're a cab driver for 3 or 4 years, to everybody that you've met in those years, you're a cab driver.
Right, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
When you go to an interview and people ask you what you do, you'll meet the odd employer who say, well, you know, I'd be proud to have an employee who would go and drive a cab when they couldn't make money any other way.
Yep.
But most of them will say, well, you know, you might have been to architecture school, but, you know, yeah, I don't see you as an architect anymore.
Right.
I mean, you've been driving a cab for 4 years. You know, how could you possibly be an architect now? I mean, we're in Canada and in Britain. We're a professional elite. You know, I can't admit you to my professional elite because you've been driving a cab.
Yep.
They won't say it, but that's the way it works.
And you know, not only that, you have the fact that, you know, if you're a recent immigrant and maybe your language skills aren't up to speed, you're going into an interview and it's really difficult for you to properly express the experience and the qualifications that you have with the same eloquence that you would in your native tongue, in your mother tongue. And that's an issue as well. Like, you're competing, if I was a recent immigrant, I'm here competing against all these native-born Canadians who I may have more experience than them, but I can't express it in the same way that they can.
Yeah, so to your interviewer, you sound like a taxi driver, too.
Exactly right. And that's a huge barrier to overcome. Language is a huge barrier, and it's always cited as one of the number one issues by recent immigrants as to why they can't find a job or why they can't find gainful employment. So definitely something that we're hoping that, you know, maybe not necessarily now, but over time, you know, we'll make slower reforms to the system and hopefully we'll help them out.
Well, with the importance being placed on recruiting the immigrant vote by Stephen Harper, I am surprised we haven't heard more about lifting immigrants out of the low-income category, given the skills that they already have.
Right.
I hate to think of them in the same category as fixed income people, but cab driving, you know, the meter rate charge is up to the cities. The cities are often slow. In fact, a case could be made that they're habitually slow to raise the meter rates.
Right.
So that over time, the meter rates fall, and they're in the same position as people on fixed incomes with regard to food inflation and the squeeze this puts them in. At the other end of the tunnel, if this situation isn't resolved, appears the specter of health care costs rising too.
Right.
And people like the Premier of Ontario who say they care about health care costs, or even any of the other opposition leaders federally who would make the claim they care about health care costs, clearly don't care about health care costs if they're permitting these people's nutrition and their peace of mind, the stress in their lives, to deteriorate.
We see the statistics and food inflation is something that we're expecting. You know, we know that the Social Security net needs reform. We know that the immigration system needs reform. Whether or not that's...
Well, we know the health system needs reform.
We know the health system needs reform.
Who's coming to us with a solution?
Right.
Yeah.
This is what I've always wanted for the young voters. You know, people always talk about young voter apathy and people not getting out there to vote. What I think the key thing is that if you're going to go out and vote, you need to make sure that you know what the issues are and that you know what's going on and that, you know, voting for a particular party requires you to know that. So voter apathy, it's not just enough to go out and vote. You need to go out
and
understand what the issues are first.
Yeah, inform yourself.
Inform yourself, because if you're voting just for the sake of voting, then there's not really any point to that.
Yeah. So if, for instance, if the issues aren't clear to someone like me who makes a habit of commenting on them, if the answers to the problems, to the issues, aren't clear, then maybe the thing to do is, beyond seeking out information about the party's platforms and statements, if they don't ring true, maybe the thing to do is call up a candidate and ask, hey, I haven't heard anything about immigration reform. I haven't heard anything about the impact of food inflation on the health system. I haven't heard anything about fixed incomes. What are your platform planks on these? And if they don't have one, well, then they're made aware that people are concerned.
Right, absolutely. And that's how that's how people come up with their platforms in the first place. They
right.
they listen to their electorate and they say, okay, well, you know, my electorate is worried about healthcare. My electorate is worried about food prices or energy prices. And this is how they develop their platforms. So absolutely, I think you're right that these are the issues that people need to go out and find out about.
Okay. Hit the bricks, people. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time with me today.
It was my pleasure, Jeff.
Thanks, Francis.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the articles we read to you from the newspapers. These are excerpts from the articles whose newspapers we identify on the broadcast. Of course, this is Florence Nightingale's birthday. Florence Nightingale also suffered from chronic fatigue, and this is MEFM Awareness Day, May the 12th. The lead story, sick and tired of being called lazy. There is no blood test or other exam that can positively identify chronic fatigue syndrome. Rather, chronic fatigue syndrome is a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning it's made only after doctors have ruled out other possible conditions. The medical community also doesn't have a clear understanding of what causes the disorder and how it develops. As a result, most people who have chronic fatigue syndrome are often faced with misconceptions and stereotypes. For instance, that it's not a real condition, and that anyone who has it is simply lazy, tired, or unmotivated. The extent of the prejudices against chronic fatigue sufferers came to light recently in a hearing before the Public Service Labor Relations Board, a tribunal that hears grievances from federal employees. Teresa Panacci, a chronic fatigue sufferer who works at the Canadian Border Services Agency in Mississauga, launched a grievance after her employer moved her from a sedentary position behind a desk in 2004 to a job in the mailroom where she had to lift and move heavy parcels. Ms. Panacci worked in the mailroom for several months but eventually collapsed on the job. She then went on sick leave for nearly a year. CBSA had asked Health Canada to perform a fitness-to-work evaluation when Ms. Panacci complained about being moved to the more physically demanding position. A doctor who didn't personally examine her said there didn't seem to be any physical reason why she couldn't work in the mailroom and suggested the problem was her attitude, not chronic fatigue syndrome. The assessment report stated, "There is a matter of motivation and job satisfaction involved more than a medical condition, according to evidence presented at Ms. Panacci's hearing." The adjudicator ruled in her favor and ordered her employer to reimburse her for time lost to sick leave and the 4 years in which she was only able to work part-time because of her chronic fatigue syndrome symptoms. Details of the case published on the Labor Relations Board website in January demonstrate how pervasive negative stereotypes against people with chronic fatigue syndrome are. Margaret Parler, president of the National ME-FM Action Network, an advocacy group for people with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, said part of the reason the disorder doesn't have broad recognition is it's difficult for others to understand it. Quote, "The severe ones that are severely fatigued, these people talk about just having the energy to clean their teeth and comb their hair in the morning," said Eva Libman, associate director of the Behavioral Psychotherapy and Research Unit in the Psychiatry Department at Jewish General Hospital in Montreal. She added that people diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome often have problems maintaining proper nutrition because they have difficulty mustering the energy to regularly shop for groceries and prepare meals. "It's a whole cascade of effects that can happen," Mrs. Parler said. "To a large extent, it's because the medical cause of this is not understood and there's not a test for it." That story by Carly Weeks in the Globe and Mail, Monday, March 21st. Electricity prices rise 3.8%. Peak rate power period ends 2 hours earlier at 7 p.m. after May the 1st. Ontario residents without fixed-price contracts saw the price of energy portion on their electricity bills rise 3.8% or more on May the 1st. But the Liberal government argues that consumers are no worse off because of the 10% rebate that kicked in last January. The new power rates were announced by the Ontario Energy Board. The board's new prices, adjusted twice a year, will boost the overall power bill for a household using 800 kilowatt hours of power a month by $3.96, or 3.8% if they are on time-of-use rates. For households on time-of-use rates, which now make up the majority in the province, energy rates at each of the three daily pricing periods will climb by 0.8 cents a kilowatt hour. This will put the peak rate at 10.7 cents a kilowatt hour, the mid-peak rate at 8.9 cents a kilowatt hour, and the off-peak rate at 5.9 cents a kilowatt hour. But the peak rate period ends 2 hours earlier, at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m., starting May the 1st. Electricity prices are expected to be a battleground in October's provincial election, said John Jakubowski of the Conservatives. The Liberals are handing out exorbitant contracts to producers of renewable power and some other generators. Andrea Horvath, leader of the New Democrats, said the rate hike makes a mockery of the 10% break through the government's clean energy benefit. This government continues to make life less and less affordable, she said, noting the rebates are paid for through taxes. They're putting money in with one hand and taking it out with the other. Horvath said the NDP would scrap the 8% provincial portion of the HST on electricity bills, although the Liberal government maintains it has done better than that with the 10% rebate. With the Ontario election coming October 6th and rates rising, the reality that people see when they open up their bills is not a spin. It's a fact, Horvath said. That article from the Toronto Star, John Spears, business reporter. Grocers scramble to offset higher food fuel costs. Call it the incredible shrinking package. Loblaw Companies Limited recently scaled back to 750 grams from 800 grams, the amount of cereal in a box of one of its President's Choice granolas, but has also raised the price to $5.79 from $4.99 last year. Loblaw is far from alone in downsizing packages and upsizing prices. In March, the tab for food bought in stores jumped 3.7%, marking the biggest year-over-year increase in 19 months, according to Statistics Canada. Surges in global commodity prices, spiraling fuel prices, and bad weather in the southern U.S. are continuing to drive up prices, and higher gas prices threaten to curb consumer spending. Grocers have reported lower prices than StatsCan because their customers trade down, opting for cheaper alternatives than the items listed in the federal agency's sample of groceries. But the retailers acknowledge that they're starting to raise prices. Already this year, Loblaw hiked prices of vegetables, fruits, and meats. Other price adjustments are more subtle, such as shrinking packages or launching new products. In response to a cautious consumer, grocers try to camouflage price increases by downsizing packaging, rolling out new products, or adding healthy-for-you components to justify higher rates, said Michael Mulvey, marketing professor at the University of Ottawa Telfer School of Management. Consumers often don't readily notice a different package or content size, he said. So potato chips all of a sudden contain 15% less chips, but the bag size won't change much. That story in the Globe and Mail by Marina Strauss, retailing reporter. Turmoil in the produce aisle. Retailers are racing to focus more on their own discount arms, straining their margins and forcing them to find savings elsewhere. Milk prices have gone up. Bread prices have gone up a bit. Fruits and vegetables is up because of the growers' unseasonable weather. Eric LaFleche, chief executive officer of Metro Incorporated, the country's third largest grocer, said. But the big spike you see in consumer price index numbers for vegetables in March, for example, is not what we are experiencing in our customers' shopping basket. Because when those things happen, people just avoid those products and we don't even sell any because of the switching going on. Statistics Canada's numbers often vary from what grocers actually experience, said BMO Nesbitt Burns analyst Peter Sklar, because the agency measures a fixed basket, whereas in reality consumers substitute for categories that are inflating rapidly and seek categories that are deflating rapidly. Mr. Sklar added that he's concerned about the Canadian grocery sector with respect to the impact of wholesale food inflation and the potential inability of the grocers to entirely pass through those cost increases at the retail level due to competitive pressures. Metro isn't alone in feeling the need to step up its discount groceries. Loblaw Companies Limited, the top grocer in Canada, is focusing more than ever on its low-cost division, adding more discount no-frills stores across the country, while investing in its discount Real Canadian Superstores. Sobeys, too, is pouring money into converting its discount Price Chopper stores to Freshco. Discount chains shave costs by carrying one-third fewer products than a mainstream supermarket. A discounter often stocks just two brand options in a food category, while a conventional grocer has three. That again by Marina Strauss in the Globe and Mail. Food power to the people. 30 years after a cross-country team of Canadian food advocates first convened in an effort to develop a national food strategy, a revamped and expanded version of that group issued a 27-page roadmap to food system change. As the price of oil goes up, we're seeing the price of food go through the roof, said Robin Tunnicliffe, an organic fruit and vegetable grower from Vancouver Island, who works on the People's Food Policy Project, or PFPP, and serves on the board of USC Canada, one of the key organizations to support the project. If we had vibrant regional food systems, which are entirely possible with a few changes in policy, our food system would be more resilient to external shocks that have caused chaos, she said. Titled Resetting the Table, A People's Food Policy for Canada, the report seeks to recalibrate the domestic distribution of homegrown food by creating local and regional purchasing policies for institutions and large food retailers. The aim is to ensure food is eaten as close to possible to where it's produced. It also suggests a shift in Canadian agriculture and aquaculture toward more environmentally friendly practices and the creation of policies that help new farmers enter the profession. A national poverty elimination plan and a children and food strategy, including a national school meal program, are pillars of the document. Rod McRae, one of Canada's foremost food policy experts at York University, said the true test of the disparate food policy efforts, regardless of the harmony they've realized thus far, will be in whether the government can muster a worthy response. Quote, will a government have the capacity to try and extract the most useful and robust elements from all these different pieces and try to create some national consensus around it? Or will they actually be paralyzed and do nothing? End quote. And that by Jessica Leader, global food reporter in the Globe and Mail. Another break on disrespect. Eric Hovey, Can't Fall Down.
Never say die. Don't jump, baby. You know that you can't fly. Won't get worse. You paid the price. There's a silver lining in this fool's paradise. Can't fall down. Just remember when the wolf comes round, can fall down, babe, when you're already on the ground. Can't fall down. Cross your fingers when catching straws. Just remember when the wolf comes out. You can't fall down, babe, when you're already on the ground. Can't fall down. Can't fall down.
Apology for G20 secret law. Province promises to repeal World War II legislation, but will not say sorry despite damning report. The Ontario government's refusing to apologize for its secret G20 law that resulted in hundreds of arrests, but few charges that stuck, despite a damning report on it by former Chief Justice Roy McMurtry. At first reported in The Star, the widely respected McMurtry recommended the Public Works Protection Act be repealed because the broad arrest powers it gives police are beyond troubling. He pointed a finger at Premier Dalton McGuinty's government for failing to properly communicate the so-called secret law approved by Cabinet under the Act at the request of Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair, and for wrongly creating the impression police could demand identification or search without warrant anyone coming within 5 meters of the G20 security fence last June. The rules only applied to areas inside the security zone. The problem is the government shrugs, said New Democrat MPP and Justice critic Peter Cormos, calling the report an indictment of the McGuinty government and the way it created the impression police had more authority. Most police thought they were following the letter of the law. The police were duped, as well as the public. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association said it feels vindicated by the report's critical tone. But General Counsel Natalie DeRosier told The Star a full inquiry still remains necessary to get to the bottom of why so many peaceful protesters were rounded up. That by Rob Ferguson, Queen's Park Bureau of the Toronto Star. Smith family settles lawsuit. Teen inmate who took home life feared she'd never leave prison. A mother who accused the prison system of conspiring to torture her teenage daughter has settled her wrongful death suit against the federal government. It was settled to the satisfaction of all parties, said Julian Faulkner, lawyer for Coralie Smith, whose mentally ill daughter, Ashley, 19, died in a segregation cell at Kitchener's Grand Valley Institution. While Smith's family sought $1 million, the parties would not release details of the settlement, citing a confidentiality clause. Federal officials were unavailable for comment. Smith died October 19, 2007. She strangled herself with a piece of cloth as guards watched. Prison managers believe Smith, who had been declared suicidal by medical staff, was playing games and told staff they would be disciplined if they entered her cell while she appeared to be breathing. Toward the end of her life, Smith's habit of tying ligatures around her neck escalated. One prison report concluded she was reaching out for human action. Shortly before her death, she reached out to a nurse at the Regional Psychiatric Center in Saskatoon, one of five correctional institutions she was sent to during her 11 months in federal custody. "I sometimes feel like I will never get out," Smith told nurse Cindy Chorchewski in a handwritten letter dated August 2007 from NOAA Institution in Truro, Nova Scotia, which she signed XOXOXO, Love, Ashley, with a picture of a heart. "I miss our late-night chats," it said. "No one does that here. It's different, I guess. No one takes the time to talk. Every time I hear, 'keep holding on,' I think about you." The letter was entered in divisional court this week, where a panel of judges will decide if an Ontario coroner erred in refusing to seize shocking prison videos for the upcoming inquest. The tape shows Smith strapped to a metal gurney for 12 hours while a prison nurse forcibly injected her with tranquilizers, according to a prison report. They also show a pilot duct taping Smith to the seat of a plane when she was transferred from Saskatoon to a psychiatric hospital in Montreal. Falconer argued they're critical to determining a means of death other than suicide. Lawyers for the Correctional Service and coroner argued the divisional court must defer to presiding coroner Dr. Benita Porter's expertise. On Tuesday, the judges reserved decision. The inquest where Smith's lawyer wants the video viewed starts May 16th in Toronto. That by Diana Zlumslick, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. And the good news story, a little dated but unavailable with the show's schedule until now. Infant at Center of Medical Ethical Debate returns home. Baby Joseph Marachli, who went to the United States for a tracheotomy after doctors in Canada refused to treat him, is back home and will be looked after by the Windsor Regional Hospital. Joseph, who's terminally ill and suffers from Leigh syndrome, a progressive neurological disease, traveled with his family to the SSM Cardinal Glennon Children's Medical Center in St. Louis, Missouri. The center said in a statement Thursday that Joseph responded very well to a tracheotomy procedure, which created an opening into his windpipe through an incision made in his neck. For about a week, Joseph was breathing on his own without the help of a mechanical ventilator. Doctors in London, Ontario, had refused to perform the tracheotomy, saying it was futile because the disease was terminal. Doctors also wanted to take Joseph off assisted breathing, which was challenged in court by Joseph's parents, who lost. And that story in the Globe and Mail, Laura Conrad. That's all the news we have this week for Disrespect. Come back next week, though. We will have more. Tonight, we're going to introduce a new feature called Under the Hammer. When we have an interview and news, it's going to be at the end of the news. When we have only an interview, it's going to be before the interview. Tonight, the first installment of Under the Hammer. The organization that has stepped in the deep doo-doo this time is a Hamilton landlord. If you've been listening to the show for the last year and a half, 18 months ago, we talked about a woman who had an apartment overrun by mice. Her landlord wasn't doing anything about it, and she was beside herself. She had an anxiety disorder. She had some learning disabilities. She was working. She was supporting herself. But the city wouldn't do anything, and the landlord wouldn't do anything. And yes, full disclosure, she is known to the show. 18 months later, most of the mice are gone, probably thanks to Disrespect. Now she's still living with all her things in boxes, breaking out all over in welts. She and her social worker feel her immune system has been compromised because she's tired all the time. She can't remember things clearly. If you've had mice, you may be aware that they leave behind huge amounts of urine and pellets, and that these are toxic. In fact, they may even be fatally dangerous with some species of mice. At any rate, she's going to see her doctor and find out what really might be going on. This is the landlord's responsibility to rectify. The landlord is doing nothing. In fact, a branch of the landlord also runs a city housing waiting list. She's asked for a subsidy on a one-bedroom apartment because her earnings are very low. And she's asked for a balcony, which, because of her anxiety disorder, she requires to get outside the apartment walls sometimes. She's been offered by the organization linked to her landlord a bachelor apartment. We're hoping it doesn't take too long to find among the many apartments being vacated in Hamilton an apartment suitable for this woman. I'm so deserving because she could be on Ontario Disability Support Plan. Instead, she works, and she gets back disrespect. She is under the hammer. If you have an issue like this, email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-A-U-E, dialogue at radio.fm for Under the Hammer. To take us out, in keeping with our focus on food inflation, a little gem I found in the new releases section of the CFMU library, Susie Vinnick, Oreo Cookie Blues.
I got some chocolate on my fingers, icing on my lips, sugar toppings. I got way too much blubber on my hips. I keep the nightlight burning in the kitchen, baby, so I can go downstairs and cruise. I got them Oreo cream sandwich, chocolate covered cream filled cookie blues. Whoa, I hide them in a cabinet, I keep them in a jar, and for emergencies I keep them in the glove compartment of my car. You know I can't live without them. Oh no, they get me high, then I get on blues. I got them Oreo cream sandwich, chocolate covered cream.
Pushing up a whole bunch of daisies, girl, and quite frankly, I kind of think that you're sick. I can't live without them. Oh no, I don't wanna lose. I don't wanna lose. I got them Oreo cream sandwich, chocolate covered cream filled cookie, built by Nabisco, and you know they. I got the next best thing to Nookie. Blues. And Mr. Christie, you just don't compare. Oh no.
Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.